Malamba spoke quietly to his friends. It seems the Emperor is less than ecstatic at the news. Hojo Pepper and Shimon turned to watch the Emperor, who was sitting with a stoic expression upon his face. Hojo Pepper said,
He hides it well, but I think you are right, Malamba. Something in all this disturbs him.
Malamba said nothing, knowing well enough the cause. This victory would blunt the Blue Wheel Peace Initiative and would gain the warlord more power at the Emperor's expense. Shimon tapped Malamba upon the shoulder. The games begin. As the doors on the arena floor opened to admit the combatants, Malamba studied the Emperor. He was young, in his early 20s, and possessed a look of intelligence. His brow was high, and his reddish-brown hair was allowed to grow to his shoulders. He turned in Malamba's direction to speak with a priest at his side, and Malamba could see his clear green eyes glint in the sun. Their eyes made contact for a moment, and there was a brief flicker of recognition, and Malamba thought, So you have been told of my part in your plan. The Emperor continued his conversation without missing a beat, and no one else saw the exchange. Hojo Pepper said,
This is a clemency spectacle. They will all fight until only one stands. He will be pardoned for his crimes.
What are their crimes? Malamba asked. Shimon answered,
The usual, petty theft, begging without temple authority, bearing false witness, avoiding taxes, disobeying lawful orders, and the like.
What about capital crimes?
Murder, treason, blasphemy, striking one's master, all are unpardonable crimes.
His voice rose to carry over the crowd noises.
They are put in with war prisoners who will not serve as slaves. They are sentenced to fight over and over until they are killed.
A guard of soldiers left the floor, abandoning the sand to the prisoners. Hojo Pepper said,
Common criminals. There will be little sport.
There seemed to be accuracy in the remark, for the prisoners were a sad-looking lot. Naked but for loincloths, they stood with weapons and shields that were foreign to them. Many were old and sick, seemingly lost and confused, holding their axes, swords, and spears loosely at their sides. The trumpet sounded the start of combat, and the old and sick ones were quickly killed. Several had never even raised their weapons in defense, being too confused to try to stay alive. Within minutes, nearly half the prisoners lay dead or dying on the sand. Shortly, the action slackened, as combatants came to face opponents of more equal skill and cunning. Slowly, the numbers diminished, and the free-flowing, riotous nature of the contest changed. Occasionally, when an opponent fell, a combatant was left standing next to another fighting pair. Often, this resulted in three-way combat, which the mob approved with loud cheering, as the awkward combat would result in an excess of bloodshed and pain. At the end, three fighters remained. Two of them had not managed to resolve their conflict. Both were on the verge of exhaustion. The third man approached cautiously, keeping equal distance between himself and both men, looking for an advantage. He had it a few seconds later. Using knife and sword, he jumped forward and dealt one of the combatants a blow to the side of the head that felled him. Shimon said,
The idiot! Couldn't he see the other man is the stronger fighter? He should have waited until one man was clearly at an advantage, then struck at him, leaving the weaker opponent to fight.
Malamba felt shaky. Shimon, his former teacher, was his closest friend after Hojo Pepper. Yet for all his education, all his wisdom, he was howling after the blood of others as if he were the most ignorant commoner in the least expensive seat. No matter how he tried, Malamba could not master the Surani enthusiasm for the death of others. He turned to Shimon and said, I'm sure he was a little too busy to trouble himself over the finer points of tactics. His sarcasm was lost on Shimon, closely watching the combat. Malamba noticed Hochopepa was ignoring the contest. The wily magician was taking note of every conversation in the stands. To him, the games were only another opportunity to study the subtle aspects of the game of the council. Malamba found this blindness to the death and suffering below as disturbing as Shimon's enthusiasm. The fight was quickly over, the man with the knife winning. The crowd greeted the victory with enthusiasm. Coins were thrown on the sand so that the victor would return to society with a small amount of capital. While the arena was being cleared, Shimon called over a herald and inquired about the balance of the day's activities. He turned to the others, obviously pleased at the news.
There are only a few matched pairs, then two special matches, a team of prisoners against a starving Haruth, and a match between some soldiers from Midkemia and captured Tyril warriors. That should prove most interesting.
Malamba's expression indicated that he didn't agree. Judging the time right for the question, he said,
Hocho, have you noticed any of the Shinzawe family in attendance?
He glanced around the stadium, looking for the family banners of the more prominent houses of the empire.
Min Wanabi, Anna Sati, Kida, Tonmagu, Zacatecas, Akoma? No, Malamba. I can't say if any of your former, benefactors are to be seen about. Not that I would expect them to be.
Why?
They find themselves in the warlord's bad graces of late. Something to do with failing some task or another he gave them. And I have heard that they are considered suspect, despite their clan suddenly rejoining the war effort. The Kanazawe clan is lost in its past glories, and the Shinzawe are the most old-fashioned of the lot.
Through the afternoon, the matches wore on, each more artful than the previous as the skill level of the opponents increased. Soon, the last pairs were done. Now the crowd waited in hushed anticipation. Even the nobles quieted, for the next event was unusual. A team of 20 fighters, Midkemian from their size, marched out into the center of the arena. They carried ropes, weighted nets, spears, and long curved knives. They wore only loincloths, their bodies oiled and gleaming in the late afternoon light. They stood around looking relaxed, but the soldiers in the crowd recognized the subtle signs of tension common to fighters before a battle. After a minute, the large double doors at the opposite end of the stadium opened, and a six-legged horror came shambling into the arena. The Haruth was all long teeth and sharp claws, complete with a belligerent attitude and a hide-like armor, and close to the size of a Midkemian elephant. It hesitated only long enough to blink at the light, then charged straight at the party of men before it. They scattered before the creature, seeking to confuse it. The Haruth, through simple or single-mindedness, pursued one hapless fellow. In three enormous strides, he ground the man underfoot, then gobbled him down in two bites. The others regrouped behind the animal and quickly deployed the nets. The hexapod spun about, faster than looked possible for a creature of such bulk, and charged again. This time the men waited until the last moment, tossed the nets, then dived away. The nets were edged with hooks to catch in the thick hide of the beast. It stepped into them and soon was busily tearing apart the mesh. While it was momentarily occupied, the spearman ran in to strike. The Haruth reacted in confusion, not being sure from which quarter its torment originated. The spears were proving ineffectual, for they could not penetrate the hide of the beast, Quickly realizing the futility of this approach, one fighter grabbed another and pointed to the rear of the creature. They dashed back toward the tail, which was sweeping back and forth along the ground with the force of a battering ram. They conferred momentarily, then dropped their spears as the creature decided upon a target. It lashed forward and had another man in its maw. For a moment it was still as it swallowed its prey. The two men at the rear ran forward, leaping high up onto the tail of the animal. It seemed not to notice for a moment, then reacted by swinging around violently, throwing the second man off. Having come completely about, it stopped to devour the stunned man. The other somehow contrived to hang on and employed the few moments the Harulth used to eat his comrade to pull himself higher on the creature's tail, where it joined the animal's haunches. With an overhand stroke, he plunged his long-bladed knife between two vertebrae where they were outlined by loose-hanging skin. It was a desperate gamble, and the stadium crowd screamed approval. The knife penetrated the tough cartilage between the bone segments and pierced the spinal column. The creature bellowed with rage and started to spin, threatening to toss the unwelcome rider, but in a moment the rearmost pair of legs collapsed. The Harulth stood baffled for a moment, its two forward pairs of legs pulling against the dead weight of its hind quarters. Twice it tried vainly to snap at its small tormentor, but its thick neck was insufficient for the task. The man pulled the blade loose and crawled forward along the spine while the surviving spearmen darted in and out, distracting the creature. Three times he was nearly tossed off the animal's back, but somehow he managed to retain his position. When he found himself slightly forward of the middle pair of legs, he drove his blade between vertebrae. The central legs collapsed an instant later, and the man was thrown clear of the animal's back. The Harulth screamed its rage and pain, but was effectively immobilized. The fighters backed away and waited. Two spinal cuts proved to be enough. For minutes later, the Harulth fell over in shock, thrashed its forelegs for a time, and lay still. The crowd shouted its enthusiastic approval of the contest, for never had a group of fighters bested a Harulth without losing at least five times as many men. In this contest, only three had died. The fighters stood around, exhaustion causing weapons to fall from limp fingers. The battle had lasted less than 10 minutes, but the expenditure in energy, concentration, sweat, and fear had worn each man to near prostration. Numbly oblivious to the crowd's cheering, they stumbled toward the exit. Only the man who had actually driven in the knife showed any expression, and he was openly weeping as he moved across the sand. "Why do you think that man is so distraught?" asked Shimon. "It was a grand triumph." Malamba said in a voice forced to calmness, "Because he is exhausted and afraid and sick from it." He then added softly, "And he is very far from home." He swallowed hard, struggling against outrage, then said, "He knows it is for nothing. Again and again he will march into this arena to fight other creatures, other men, even friends from his homeland. And sooner or later he will die." Hocho Pepper stared at Malamba, and Shimon looked confused. "But for chance, I might have been with those below," added Malamba. "Those who fought are men. They had families and homes. They loved and laughed. Now they wait to die." Hocho Pepper waved a hand absently. "Malamba, you have a disturbing habit of taking things personally." Malamba felt sickened and angered by the bloody spectacle, but forced those emotions down within himself. He was determined to stay. He would be Surani. The sand was cleared and trumpets blew again, signalling the final match of the afternoon. A dozen proud-looking warriors dressed in leather battle harnesses, wristbands set with studs, and headdresses plumed in many colours, came striding out of one end of the arena. Melamba had never seen their like in person, but recognized their dress from his vision on the tower. These were the descendants of the proud serpent riders, the Turil. Each wore a hard-eyed expression of grim determination. From the other end, 12 warriors in color-splashed imitations of Midkemian armor marched out. Their own metal armor had been deemed both too valuable and too dull for the contest, and Surani artisans had provided stylized imitations. The Turil stood watching the newcomers with implacable contempt. Of all the races of humanity, only the Turil had been able to withstand the Empire. The Turil were uncontestedly the finest mountain fighters in Kellywan, and their mountain holds and high farm pastures were impossible to conquer. They had held the Empire at bay for years until peace had been declared. They were a tall people, the result of their lack of interbreeding with the shorter races of Kellywan, whom they considered inferior. The trumpets blew again, and a hush fell over the crowd. A herald shouted in a clear voice, "As these soldiers of the Turil Confederacy have violated the treaty between their own nations and the Empire, by making war upon the soldiers of the Emperor, they have been cast out by their own people, who have named them outlaws and bound them over for punishment. They will fight the captives from the world of Midkemia. All will strive until one is left standing." The crowd cheered. The trumpet sounded and the fighters squared off. The Midkemians crouched, weapons at the ready. But the Turil stood tall, defiant looks upon their faces. One of the Turil strode forward, halting before the nearest Midkemian. With contemptuous tones, he spoke rapidly and made a sweeping motion around the arena. Melamba felt a hot flush of anger begin to grow inside, coupled with shame at what he was seeing. There were games in Midkemia, he had heard of them, but they were nothing like this. The men who fought in Krondor and other places throughout the kingdom were professionals who made a living by fighting to first blood. Occasionally a duel to the death would be fought, but it was always a personal matter. After all, other means of settling the dispute had been exhausted. This was a mindless waste of human life for the titillation of the bored and idle, the satiated in search of more and more vivid reminders that their own lives were worth something. Melamba looked around and felt disgust at the expressions on the faces of those nearby. The Turil warrior continued his ranting, while the Midkemian watched, with something in their manner suggesting a shift of mood. Before, they were tensed, battle-ready. Now they seemed almost relaxed. The Turil continued pointing up at the assembled throng. Then a Midkemian, tall and broad-shouldered, stepped forward as if to speak. The Turil came on guard, his sword high, ready to strike. A voice rang out from behind as another warrior said something that carried a note of reassurance. The first Turil visibly relaxed. The Midkemian slowly removed his helm, revealing a tired, haggard face framed by damp, stringy black hair. He looked about the arena while the crowd began to whisper and grumble at the unexpected behavior of the warriors, and then gave a curt nod. He dropped his sword and shield and said something to his companions. Quickly, the other fighters in the arena followed suit, and soon all weapons were lying upon the ground. Melamba wondered at this strange behavior, and Shimon said, "This will end a shambles. The Turil will not fight their own kind, and it seems they won't fight the barbarians either. I once saw six Tyrell kill everyone sent against them, then refuse to fight one another. When the guards came to kill them, they fought, driving them back. Finally, bowmen on the wall had to shoot them down. It was a disgrace. The crowd rioted, and the games director was torn to bits. Over 100 citizens died. Melamba felt relief. At least he would be spared the spectacle of Katala's people and his own killing one another. Then the crowd began to shout their disapproval, jeering the reluctant combatants. Hochopepa nudged Melamba and said, "The warlord appears less than amused by this." Melamba saw the warlord's livid expression as he watched his presentation to the emperor turned into a farce. Almicho slowly rose from his place near the light of heaven and bellowed, "Let the fighting begin!" Burly handlers, guards who worked on behalf of the games director, ran into the arena, wielding whips. They circled the motionless fighters and began lashing out at them. Melamba felt his gorge rise as the handlers laid about, tearing the exposed skin from the arms and legs of the Tyrell and Midkemian soldiers. No stranger to the whip when in the swamp, he knew its terrible touch. He felt each stroke as it fell upon those on the sand below. The crowd began to grow restive, for watching motionless men being whipped was not what they had come to see. Jeers and catcalls rang down upon those in the imperial box, and a few bolder souls threw litter and small coins into the arena, showing what they thought of such sport. Finally, one of the handlers grew impatient, stepped up to a Tyrell warrior, and struck him across the face with a whip handle. Before the handler could react, the Tyrell sprang forward and tore the whip from the startled man's hands. In an instant, he had it firmly wrapped about the man's throat, choking him. The other handlers turned their attention to the warrior attacking their companion and began to flail wildly at him. After a dozen or so blows, the Tyrell began to wobble and fell to his knees. But he held tightly to the whip, strangling the gasping handler. Again and again blows rained down upon the Tyrell, until all his armor ran red with blood from the lashing. Still, he held on to his victim. When the handler died, eyes protruding from a blue face, whatever strength left to the Tyrell seemed to die as well. As the handler's limp body came to rest on the sand, the Tyrell warrior fell beside him. It was a Midkemian soldier who reacted first. With cold detachment, he simply picked up a sword and ran one of the handlers through. Then, as one, the Tyrell and Midkemian soldiers had weapons in hand. And within a minute, all the handlers were dead. Then, again as one, the prisoners threw their weapons to the ground. Melamba battled to stay calm in the face of such display. He felt nothing but admiration for those men. They accepted death rather than slay one another. Possibly some of those men had ridden through the valley with him on the raid to discover the rift machine so many years before. Outwardly he appeared calm, a Surani, but inwardly he seethed. Hochopepa whispered, "I have a bad feeling here. Whatever gain Almicho sought from this day to bolster his position with the Emperor is badly shaken. I fear he is not taking well your former countryman's reluctance to die for the entertainment of the light of heaven." Melamba nearly spit when he said, "Damn such entertainment!" He looked at Hochopepa with a burning expression, one never seen by the fat magician before. Melamba half stood as he added, "And damn all those who find pleasure in such bloody sport." Hochopepa seized him by the arm and tried to pull him firmly into his seat, saying, "Melamba, remember yourself." Melamba pulled himself free, ignoring the command. Melamba and his companions looked to the imperial box, where a guard captain conferred with a warlord. Melamba felt a strange hot flush inside, and for a moment battled a sudden impulse to use his powers to put the warlord amid those below, to see how he fared against those who refused to die gracefully at his command. Then Almicho's voice rang out, silencing all those nearby.
"No, no, bowmen! Those animals will not die a warrior's death."
He turned to one of his pet magicians and issued instructions. The black-robed man nodded and began to incant. Melamba felt his neck hairs rise as the presence of magic made itself known. A hush sound of awe swept about the stadium as those on the sand below fell senseless to roll about in a daze. The warlord shouted,
"Now go bind them, build a platform, and hang them for all to see."
Stunned silence greeted his words. Then shouts of,
"No, they are warriors," and "This is without honor,"
rang throughout the crowd. Hocho Pepper closed his eyes and sighed audibly. He spoke to himself as much as to his companions.
"The warlord lets his famous temper get the best of him once more. And now we have a debacle before us. This will not help his position in the High Council or the stability of the Empire."
Like an enraged beast at bay, the warlord turned, and all nearby fell silent. But those at greater distances picked up the cries. By Surani standards, this was too much of an indignity to be visited on any save those without honor. While balking the mob sport, the prisoners had shown they were still fighting men, and as such deserved an honorable death. Hocho Pepper turned to speak to Melamba, then stopped himself as he saw the expression on his friend's face. Melamba's anger was now fully revealed, his rage a match for the warlord's. Sensing something terrible was about to occur, Hocho Pepper sought Shimon's attention, only to find he was also silently watching Malamba's fearsome countenance. All Hocho Pepper could manage to say was a quiet, "Melamba, no!" Then the slave become magician was moving. He swept past the shocked Hocho Pepper, saying only,
"See to the Emperor's safety."
Melamba was reeling with the impact of sudden emotion bottled up for years, now surging free. A strange and powerful certainty struck him.
"I am not Surani," he acknowledged to himself. "I could not be a party to this."
For the first time since donning the black robe, his two natures were in harmony. This was a dishonor by the standards of both cultures, something that filled him with a dread purpose free of any doubt. Save those near the imperial box, the entire crowd was chanting, "The sword! The sword! The sword!" demanding a warrior's death for each man below. The rhythm became a pounding pulse beat for Melamba, heightening his nearly unchecked fury. Reaching a point between the magicians and the imperial box, Melamba regarded the soldiers and carpenters rushing onto the arena floor. The stunned Midkemians and Tyrill were being bound like animals for slaughter, and the crowd's anger was reaching a dangerous level. Some of the younger officers of noble families in the lower levels of the stadium seemed ready to take swords and jump onto the sand to contest personally for the prisoners' right to die as warriors. These had been valiant foemen, and many of those watching had fought against both Tyrill and Kingdom soldiers. They would willingly kill these men on the field of battle, but would not watch this humiliation visited on brave enemies. A black flood of anger, loathing, and sorrow poured through Melamba. His mind screamed in outrage, despite his attempts to control it. His head tilted back, and his eyes rolled up into his head. And as had happened twice before in his life, letters of fire appeared in his mind's eye. But never before had he had the strength to seize the moment, and with a nearly animal joy, he dived into the newly opening well of power within. His right arm shot forward, and energy exploded from his hand. A bolt of blue flame, scintillating even in the sunlight, hurled downward to strike the sand amid the warlord's guards. Living men were swept in all directions, like leaves before the wind. Those just entering with the materials for the scaffolding were knocked to their knees by the blast, and those in the lower seats were stunned by its fury. All noise in the arena stopped as the crowd fell into mute shock. All eyes turned to the source of that bolt, while those near him reflexively drew back. He was red-faced with anger, and the whites of his eyes showed around dark irises as he scanned the arena. With a short, chopping motion of one hand, the magician said, "No more!" No one moved save Hocho Pepper and Shimon. They had no idea what Malamba's intentions were, but in the face of this act, they took his command seriously. They hurried to where a half-stunned, half-fascinated young emperor sat watching with everyone else in the stadium. They quickly conferred with Ichindar, and a moment later, the emperor's seat was empty. Malamba looked to his left as a bellow of outrage sounded.
"Who dares this?"
Malamba was confronted by the sight of the warlord, standing like an enraged demigod in his white armor. The warlord's expression matched Malamba's.
"I dare this," Malamba shouted back. "This cannot be, will not be. No more will men die for the sport of others."
Barely holding himself in check, Almicho, warlord of the nations of Suranuani, screamed,
"By what right do you do this thing?"
The cords on his neck stood out clearly, and every muscle of his body quivered as sweat beaded his brow. Malamba's voice lowered, and his words came carefully measured with controlled, defiant rage.
"By my right to do as I see fit."
He then spoke to a nearby guard. "Those on the arena floor are to be released. They are free." The guard hesitated for a moment. Then his Sirani training came to the fore.
"Your will, Great One."
The warlord shouted,
"You will stay!"
The crowd hissed with intaken breath. In the history of the Empire, such a confrontation between Great One and warlord had never occurred. The guard stopped, and Malamba spoke through a snarl.
"My words are as law. Go!"
Suddenly the guard was moving, and the warlord screamed his rage.
"You break the law! No one may free a slave!"
His anger boiling back up again, Malamba shouted back,
"I can! I am outside the law!"
The warlord fell back, as if struck an invisible blow. In his life, no one had dared to thwart his will in this manner. No warlord in history had ever been forced to endure such public shame. He was dazed. Near the warlord, another magician leaped to his feet.
"I call you traitor and false, Great One. You seek to undermine the warlord's rule and bring chaos to the order of the Empire. You will recant this effrontery."
Instantly there was frantic activity as all within earshot scrambled to get clear of the two magicians. Malamba regarded the warlord's pet.
"Do you think to match your powers against mine?"
The warlord looked at Malamba with naked hatred on his face. He never took his eyes from the young magician's face as he said to his pet,
"Destroy him!"
Malamba's arm shot upward, crossing at the wrists. Instantly, a soft, golden nimbus of light surrounded him. The other magician hurled a bolt of energy, and the blue ball of fire struck harmlessly against the gold shield. Malamba tensed, suffused with anger. Twice before in his life, when attacked by the trolls and when fighting with Roland, he had reached into hidden reservoirs of power and drawn upon them. Now he tore aside the last barriers between his conscious mind and those hidden reserves. They were no longer a mystery to him, but the wellspring from which all his power stemmed. For the first time in his experience, Malamba came to understand fully what he was, who he was. Not a black robe, limited by the ancient teachings of one world, but an adept of the greater art, a master in full possession of all the energy provided by two worlds. The warlord's magician regarded him in fear. Here was more than a curiosity, a barbarian magician. Here stood a figure to awe, arms stretched upward, body trembling with rage, eyes seemingly aglow with strength. Malamba clapped his hands above his head, and thunder pealed, rocking those around him. Energy exploded upward from his hands, held high above his head. A vortex of coruscating forces spun above him, rising like a bowshot. The fountain continued until it was high overhead. It began to flatten, covering the stadium like a great canopy. The dazzling display continued briefly. Then the sky seemed to explode, blinding many who were looking upward. The sky turned dark, and the sun faded as if grey veils were slowly being drawn before it. Malamba's voice carried to the farthest corner of the stadium as he said, "That you have lived as you have lived for centuries is no license for this cruelty. All here are now judged, and all are found wanting." More magicians departed, disappearing from their seats, but many yet remained. More judicious commoners fled by nearby exits, but still many waited, thinking this but another contest for their amusement. Many were too drunk or excited by the spectacle for the magician's warning to reach them. Malamba's arm swept an arc around him. "You who would take pleasure from the death and dishonor of others, see then how well you face destruction." A gasp from the crowd answered his pronouncement. Malamba raised one hand high overhead, and all became silent. Even the light summer breeze ceased. Then, with a terrible strength, he spoke. They paled at his words, for it was as if death had become incarnate and had spoken. Echoing throughout the stadium were the words of Malamba, "Tremble and despair, for I am power." A shrill keening sound began, with Malamba at its source. The very air shuddered as mighty magic was forged. "Wind!" Malamba cried. A bitter breeze, reeking of carrion, foul and loathsome in its touch, blew through the stadium. A low moan of sorrow and fear was carried away by the wind. It blew stronger, and each moment it grew, carried more menace, more despair. It turned colder, until it was stinging to those who had rarely known cold. Men wept at its biting caress, and high above the stadium clouds formed in the murk. The winds howled, drowning out the cries of the multitude in the arena. Nobles tried to flee, now too terrified to do anything but claw past their own families, trampling the old and slow underfoot. Many were buffeted to their knees, or knocked from the seats to the sands of the arena floor. Great thunderheads, black and grey, raced overhead, seeming to swirl around a point directly over Malamba's head. The magician was engulfed in an eerie light, pulsating with energy. He stood at the center of the storm, a terrible figure in the dark. The wind shrieked its fury, but Malamba's voice cut through the sound like a knife.
Rain!
A cold rain fell, blown hard before the gale. Quickly it grew in tempo, becoming a pounding torrent, then a deluge. The cascade pelted those below, painfully driving them down, beating them senseless with a frightening strength clearly unnatural. A few managed to flee to the tunnels, while others clutched at one another in terror. Other magicians tried to counter the spells but could not, and fainted from the exertion. Never had there been such a display of raw power. Here was a true master of magic, one who could control the very elements, come into his own. The magician who had challenged Malamba lay back across his seat, stunned, his eyes blinking as he struggled to sort some semblance of order out of the chaos around. The warlord tried to withstand the storm, struggling to remain upright and refusing to submit to the terror of those around him. Malamba dropped his arm, then raised one hand before him, stretching outward.
Fire!
He shouted, and again all could hear him. The clouds seemed to burn. The heavens erupted as sheets of terrible colors, flames of every hue, ran riot through the darkness. Jagged bolts of lightning flashed across the sky, as if the gods were announcing the final judgment of mankind. People screamed in primitive terror at the element gone mad. Then the rain of fire began. Drops struck arms and clothing, faces and cloaks, and began to burn. Shrieks of pain came from all sides, and people tried vainly to swat out the fires that burned their flesh. More magicians disappeared from the arena, taking their unconscious comrades. Malamba stood alone in the magician's section. The stink of burned flesh filled the air, mixed with the acrid odor of fear. Malamba crossed his arms before him. He turned his gaze downward.
Earth!
From below, a deep rumbling commenced. The ground under the stadium began to tremble slightly. The vibrations grew in intensity, and the air was filled with an angry buzzing, as if a swarm of giant insects had surrounded the arena. Then a low rumbling added its harmony to the buzzing, and the ground began to move. The vibrations became a shaking, then a violent, rolling, surging motion. Malamba stood calmly, as if on an island. It was as if the soil, the earth, had become fluid. People were thrown down onto the arena floor. The huge stadium throbbed from forces primeval. Statues tumbled from their pedestals, and the huge gates were ripped from their hinges in a crackling splintering of ancient wood. They moved from before the tunnels in a staggering, drunken walk, then fell to the sand, crushing those who lay before them. Many of the beasts below the arena were driven mad by the earthquake and thrashed in their cages, smashing locks and opening doors. They fled the tunnels and raced over the fallen gates. They bellowed, howled, and roared at the fire rain. Enraged by terror, they fell upon the stunned spectators lying on the sand, killing at random. A man would sit dazed, absently slapping at the burning drops from the skies, while another, a few feet away, was being gutted by some horror from the distant forests. Now the arena itself began to wail as the ancient stones moved, slipping across one another. Mortar, a millennium old, turned to dust in an instant as the very stadium crumbled. Cries for mercy were swept away by the winds or drowned in the cacophony of destruction. The fury mounted, and the world seemed ready to be torn asunder. Malamba raised his hands above his head again. He brought his palms together, and the mightiest thunder peal of all sounded. Then, abruptly, the chaos ceased. Above, the sky was clear and sunny, a light breeze once more blowing from the east. The ground stood as it should, motionless and solid, and the rain of fire was a memory. The silence that followed was deafening. Then the groans of the injured and the sobs of the terrified could be heard. The warlord remained standing, his face drained of all color, small burns scarring his features and arms. In place of the mighty leader of the empire stood a man bereft of any emotion save terror. His eyes were wide enough to show whites. His mouth moved, as if he were trying to speak, but no words were forthcoming. Malamba raised his hands overhead again, and the warlord fell back with a sob of fear. The magician clapped his hands and was gone. The afternoon breeze carried the scent of summer flowers. In the garden, Katala was playing a word game with William. She had insisted they should both learn the language of her husband's homeland. It was almost evening, for they were farther east than the holy city. The sun was low in the west, and the shadows in the garden were long. Without the chime announcing Malamba's arrival, Katala was startled when her husband appeared in the doorway of their home. She rose slowly from her seat, for she sensed at once something was wrong.
"Husband, what is it?"
William ran up to his father, while Malamba said, "I will tell you everything later. We must take William and flee." William tugged on his father's black robe.
"Papa!"
he cried, demanding attention. Malamba picked up his son and hugged him tightly, then said,
"William, we are going on a journey to my homeland. You must be a brave boy and not cry."
William stuck out his lower lip, for if his father was asking him not to cry, then there must be a very good reason to do so. But he nodded and held back the tears.
"Nitoa! Amarella!"
Malamba called, and in a moment the two servants entered the garden. Nitoa bowed, but Amarella rushed to Katala's side. Katala had insisted she accompany them to Malamba's new home when he brought his family from the Shinzawe estate. She was more sister to Katala and aunt to William than a slave. She could see at once that something was wrong, and tears came unbidden to her eyes.
"You're leaving," she said,
a statement more than a question. Nitoa looked at his master.
"Your will, great one?"
Malamba said, "We are leaving. We must. I am sorry." Nitoa took the news stoically, in the proper Surani fashion, but Almirella embraced Katala, openly weeping. Malamba said, "I wish to ensure that you are both provided for. I have prepared documents against this day. When we have gone, you will find all my work catalogued in my study. Above my study table, on the top shelf, you will find a parchment with a black seal upon it. I am giving the estate to you, Nitoa." He said to Amarella, "I know you two care for each other. The document giving Nitoa the estate also contains a provision granting you your freedom, Amarella. He will make you a good husband. Even the emperor cannot set aside a document bearing a great one's seal, so do not worry." Amarella's expression was a mixture of complete disbelief, happiness, and sorrow. She nodded slowly that she understood, thanks clearly showing in her eyes. Malamba returned his attention to Nitoa. "I am deeding the lower pasture land to Xanathus the herdsman. Provide well for the others of this household, Nitoa. Now, in my study you will also find several parchments sealed with red wax. These must be burned at once. Whatever you do,
Do not break the seals before you burn them. All other works are to be sent to Hocho Pepper of the Assembly, with my deepest affection and the wish that he find them useful. He will know what to do with them. Amarella again embraced Katala, then kissed William. Nitoa said,
Quickly, girl. You're not mistress of this estate yet, and there is important work to do.
The Hadonra started to bow, then said haltingly,
Great one, I wish you well.
He quickly bowed and started for the study. Malamba could see a hint of moisture in his eyes. Amarella, tears running down her cheeks, followed Nitoa into the house. Katala turned to Malamba.
Now?
Now. As he took them to the pattern room, he said, There is one thing I must find out before we attempt the rift. He held his wife, with their son between them, and willed himself to another pattern. They were shrouded in a white haze for an instant, then were in a different room. They hurried through the door, and Katala saw they went into the home of the Shinzawe lord. They hurried to Komatsu's study and opened the door without ceremony. Komatsu looked up, annoyed at the interruption. His expression changed immediately when he saw who was at his door.
Great one, what is it?
He asked as he arose. Malamba quickly conveyed the events of the day, and Katala paled at the recounting. The lord of the Shinzawe shook his head.
You may have set processes in motion that will forever change the internal order of the Empire, Great One. I hope it is not a death blow. In any event, it will take years to gauge their effects. Already the Party for Progress is making overtures to the Party for Peace for Alliance. In a short time you have had great effect upon my homeland.
Komatsu continued, preventing Malamba from speaking.
That is not a thing of the moment, though. You, who were once my slave, have learned greatly. But you are still not Surani. You must understand the warlord cannot allow such a setback and save face. He most likely will take his life in shame. But those who follow his lead, his family, his clan, his subordinates, will all mark you for death. Already there may be assassins hired, or magicians who are ready to act against you. You have no choice but to flee to your homeland with your family.
William decided it was appropriate now to cry, for in spite of his attempts at bravery, his mother was frightened, and the boy felt it. Malamba turned away from Komatsu and incanted a spell, and William was immediately asleep.
He will sleep until we are safe.
Katala nodded and knew it was for the best, but still she disliked the necessity.
I have no fear of any magician, Komatsu, Malamba said, but I fear for the Empire. I know now that, no matter how hard my teachers in the Assembly tried, I can never be Surani. But I do serve the Empire. In my disgust over what I witnessed in the arena, I became sure of what I've suspected for some time now. The Empire must change its course, or it is doomed to fall. The rotten, weak heart of this culture cannot support its own weight much longer, and like a Nagagi tree with a rotten core, it will collapse under its own weight. There are other things, things of which I may not speak, that I have learned in my time here. That tell me great change must come. I must leave, for should I stay, the Assembly, the High Council, all the Empire will be divided. I would have difficulty leaving the Empire, were it not in the best interest of Suranuani for me to depart. That is my training. But before I leave, I must know, has there been word from Lori and your son of the Emperor's overture of peace?
No. We know they disappeared during a skirmish the first night. Hokonu's men searched the area after the fight and found no signs of them, so it is assumed they were safely away. My younger son is certain they reached a road behind kingdom lines. Since then we have had no further word. Other members of our faction wait with as much trepidation as I.
Malamba considered. Then the Emperor is still not ready to act. I had hoped it might be soon, so we could safely leave under the truce before opposition to me becomes organized. Now, with the warlord's announcement of victory over Duke Borok's army, we may never see peace. Komatsu said,
It is clear you are not Tsurani, Great One. With the warlord in disgrace from your destruction of games he dedicated to the light of heaven, the war party will be in disorder. Now the Kanazawa clan will once more remove itself from the Alliance for War. Our allies in the Blue Wheel will work doubly hard to press for a truce in the High Council. The war party is without an effective leader. Even should the warlord prove shameless and not kill himself, he will be quickly removed, for the war party needs a strong leader. And the Minwanabi are ambitious. For 3 generations they have sought the white and gold. But others in the High Council will press the claims as well. The war party will be in disarray, and we shall gain time to strengthen our position as the game of the council continues.
Komatsu looked long at Malamba.
As I have said, there are those who are already plotting to take your life. Make for your homeworld now. Do not delay, and you should likely win safely through. It might not occur to any but a few that you will strike for the rift at once. Any other great one would take a week putting his house in order.
He smiled at Malamba.
Great one. You were a fresh breeze in a stale room while you were with us. I am sorry to see you leave our land, but you must go at once.
I hope the day will come when we may meet again as friends, Lord of the Shinzawe, for there is much that our 2 people could learn from one another. The Shinzawe Lord placed his hand upon Malamba's shoulder.
I hope also for that day, Great One. I will send prayers with you. One thing more. If you should perchance see Kasumi in your homeworld, tell him his father thinks of him. Now go, and goodbye.
Goodbye, said Malamba. He took his wife by the arm and hurried back toward the pattern room. When they reached it, a chime sounded, and Malamba pushed his wife and son behind him. A brief haze of white appeared over the pattern in the floor, and Fumita stood there, startled.
Malamba,
he said, stepping forward.
Stop, Fumita.
The older magician stood still.
I mean you no harm. Word of what occurred has reached those of the assembly not attending the games. The assembly is in turmoil. Tapek and the other warlords' pets demand your life. Hocho Pepper and Shimon argue on your behalf. Never has such discord been seen. In the High Council, the war party demands an end to the independence of the assembly during times of war, and the Party for Progress and the Party for Peace are in open alliance with the Blue Wheel Party. The Empire is upside down.
The older magician seemed to droop visibly as he related this. He looked years older than Malamba had ever remembered seeing him.
I think you may have been right in many of your beliefs, Malamba. We must have changes in the Empire if we are not to decay. But so many changes so quickly? I don't know.
There was a moment of silence between them. Malamba said, What I did was for the Empire, Fumita. You must believe that. The older magician nodded slowly.
I believe you, Melamba. Or at least, I wish to.
He seemed to stand more erect.
Whatever the outcome, there will be much for the Assembly to do when things have settled. Perhaps we can steer the Empire to a healthier course. But you must go quickly. No soldier will try to stop you, for only a few outside the Holy City know of your actions. But the warlord's pets may already be seeking you out. You caught our brothers by surprise at the games, and none singly could stand against you. But if they coordinate against you, even your vaunted powers will avail you little. You would have to kill another magician, or be killed in turn. Yes, Femita, I know. I must go. I have no desire to kill another magician, but I shall if I must.
Femita looked pained at hearing this.
How are you to reach the rift? You haven't been to the staging area, have you?
No, but I go to the City of the Plains, and from there I can command litter.
It is too slow. The litter will take over an hour to reach the staging area.
He reached into his robe and pulled out a transfer device. He held it out to Melamba.